tens of millions of terms, just a few terms. And why do we want to do that? Because we're only human and we can't calculate millions of terms in a perturbation expansion. Usually we can just calculate a small number. So this is a second technique. I should put two. So number one was Shanks, number two is Richardson. And Richardson extrapolation is used in the same way that the Shanks transformation is used to try to deduce the sum of the series without actually adding up the series. And in this case, we use Richardson extrapolation when we don't see, when the series does not appear to be an alternating series. So a typical example is this sum from n equals 1 to infinity, 1 over n squared. Okay, that's an absolutely standard example that is used. If you try to use the computer, what I showed you at the end of the last lecture, if you try to use a computer to sum this series, the summation is going to be very, very slow, because this is an example, a typical example of a relatively slowly converging series. Okay? So what I mean by that is, if you define an to be the partial sum of the series, you know that an, you know this is equal to pi squared over 6, okay? And you know that a sub n is going to tend to pi squared over 6 as n goes to infinity, but it's very, very slow. It's painfully slow, okay? So Richardson proposed a really clever, very, very simple way of summing the series without actually summing the series, okay? Finding the sum of the series without actually adding up the terms. And what he says is, what he did was this. He said, for large n, as n goes to infinity, we're going to make a model, again, just the way Shanks did, a model for the behavior of a n. Okay, so he says, let's assume that for large n, a sub n behaves like, well, the actual sum of the series, S, okay, this is what we're calling S, the actual sum of the series, with corrections of order 1 over n. Okay, so there may be some term like A over n, okay? And then there may be a correction to that, you know, B over n squared, and a correction to that, maybe C over n cubed. In other words, we're assuming that A sub n has a Taylor series in n, which is valid for large n. So it's a series in powers of 1 over n. Okay? So this is a model. It may not be, of course, it may be a series in powers of 1 over the square root of n. Could be. But this is a pretty good guess. Okay? So what does Richardson say? He says, imagine n is very large. So for the moment, let's just throw away this, okay? And we'll just assume that A sub n looks like S plus some correction term A over n, okay? Well, there are two unknowns here, S and A. So this is even simpler than Shanks, because Shanks had three unknowns. But we're going to need two equations. So let's go to the next equation. An plus 1 is S plus A over n plus 1. And these are trivial equations. They're linear. So we can solve them very easily. Take the first equation, multiply it by n. You get n an is equal to ns plus a. And take the second equation and multiply it by n plus 1. And you get n plus 1 times a n plus 1 is n plus 1 s plus a. Now, it's obvious what to do. Let's subtract the top equation from the bottom equation. And what you get is n plus 1 times a n plus 1 minus n a n is equal to s. That's it. Okay? Couldn't be simpler. Okay? So what Mr. Richardson says is, calculate n plus 1 times an plus 1 minus n times an, put it in a table, so make a table, just like a Shanks table. So here's n, okay? N could be 1, 2, 3, blah, blah, blah. And then put in here, let's, instead of calling this s, this is supposed to be s, but let's call this the first Richardson. Okay? So that's Richardson 1. So we could put in Richardson 1 as a function of n, and we can put in a bunch of entries here. Okay? And the claim is that, of course, let's put it in the second column, Richardson 1. Okay, so here's an. That's no Richardson. This, we could call this Richardson 0 or something like that. Okay, so now you put a bunch of entries in the table. These entries are supposed to be converging to S. These entries should be converging to S as well, but they should be converging faster. Okay? Now, you know what I'm going to do. What am I going to do next? Well, no, we can do that. No, you're right. We could do that. We could do Richardson and Richardson. But it's actually very pretty what we can do. We can go back to this, and instead of throwing away all these terms, we could keep B to try to do something a little bit more accurate. So we could keep two correction terms instead of one correction term. So we have A sub n is S plus A over n plus B over n squared. Okay? And now you know what I'm going to do. I'm going to multiply through now by n squared. So I get n squared a n is equal to n squared s plus n a plus b. Now look, I've got three unknowns, s, a, and b. So I'm going to need three equations. So all I need to do is to take three, you know, the next two equations in this sequence. So I have n plus 1 squared a n plus 1 equals n squared n plus 1 squared s plus n plus 1 a plus b. And then I have n plus 2 squared a n plus 2 is n plus 2 squared s plus n plus 2 a plus b. Okay. Now, I don't care what the values of a and b are. I want to solve for s. Can you just see right away what is the trick? What am I going to do? I mean, what's the cleverest, most efficient way of getting S out of this system of equations? I mean, of course, there's three simultaneous equations. I know you can solve them, but what's the tricky, quick way of doing it? This one? No, we have this on the board, but just think about these three equations. How do you solve them? What do we do? You see something quick and tricky and easy? How about we multiply the middle equation by minus 2, multiply the top equation by 1, you know, and the bottom equation by 1, and add them up. Do you see why that's going to work? If I multiply this by minus 2, I'll have minus 2b over here. Okay? And then a b over here and a b over here. So the b's will cancel. So it was key, it was absolutely crucial that I had a minus 2 here to cancel the b's. But look at the a's. If I multiply by minus 2, then I have here a minus 2n minus 2. Here I have an n. And here I have an n plus 2. And you see that cancels as well. Isn't that cool? Wow. Okay. So therefore, Let's look at the first term. What do you get if you take n squared and n plus 2 squared and you subtract 2 times n plus 1 squared? What's left? Say again. How about just 2? It's very pretty. So if I divide off the 2, I add them up, I divide by 2, and I get s is equal to n plus 2 squared a n plus 2 minus 2 times n plus 1 squared a n plus 1 plus, let's make a little more room, n squared a n, all divided by 2. That's all. And this is the second Richardson extrapolation. And from the structure, do you see what is happening here? There's a 1 and a minus 2 and a 1. Can you just, without even doing the calculation, can you write down R3? Exactly. So you're going to have an n plus 3 squared times a n plus 3 minus 3, okay, times a cubed, not squared, cubed, minus 3 times n plus 2 cubed, a n plus 2, plus 3, n plus 1 cubed, a n plus 1, minus a minus n cubed, a n, divided by, very good, who's the 6, absolutely. Why is it 6?
3 factorial.
Yes, and why is it, I mean, what, do you see why?
Binomial expansion, like 1, 3, 3, 1, so you're like expanding something of the form like x plus y to the n.
That's right, or allow me to give you a more, that's right, but let me give you a more mundane reason, okay? When you do, when you construct something, you know, if you have any function of n, alpha n, okay, and you construct alpha n plus 1 minus alpha n, that is the first difference, okay? So it's like a first derivative. Okay, if you construct alpha n plus 2 minus 2 times alpha n plus 1 plus alpha n, this is like the second derivative. Okay, this is the second discrete difference, so it corresponds, it's analogous to a second derivative. And if I construct alpha n plus 3 minus 3 alpha n plus 2 plus 3 alpha n plus 1 minus alpha n, this is the third difference, okay, and it's analogous to the third derivative. So why do we get 6? The reason is that if you look at the first, so first of all, why is it that the b drops out? Because b is a constant. So if you take the second here, if you take the second derivative of a constant, you get 0. That's why there's no b. Okay. Why is there no a term? Because we're taking the second derivative of n, and n corresponds to x. Okay, so if you take the second derivative, d squared dx squared, this is the continuum analog, the second derivative of x is 0. Why did we get a 2 when we took the second difference, you know, the coefficient of s? Because that's like taking d squared dx squared of x squared. Okay, which is 2. Okay? Why is it that we have a 6 here? Because when you go through the same calculation, it is as if you're taking the third derivative of x cubed. Okay? Which is 6. That's why there's a 6 in the denominator. Okay? Okay? So this is the form. You can see the pattern of the Richardsons. The next one is going to be n plus 4 to the fourth, and then there's going to be a minus 4, minus 4, and then a plus 6, and a minus 4, and a 1. And we'll be dividing by 4 factorial. Okay? So that's it. So let's just see how it works. Let's see. Okay. Okay, so let's see. You saw this before, accelerating the convergence of a convergent series. And I talked to you about about Shank's transformation. Somehow I got this in the wrong order. All right. So we're talking about Richardson extrapolation. And this is the data that I showed you for the Shank's transformation. And now here's some data for the Richardson extrapolation. And so let me come around here. OK. So if you add up the reciprocals of the squares of the integers, you get pi squared over 6. And pi squared over 6 is that number. Okay? Now, you could be dumb and use the zeroth Richardson extrapolation, meaning add up the series. And if you take one term in the series, you get 1. If you take 5 terms, you get 1.4, which is not a very good approximation to 1.6. Okay? If you take 25 terms, you're getting closer. You're getting 1.60, but the answer is 1.64. Okay? Now, if you use the second Richardson extrapolation, I'm not even bothering with the first Richardson extrapolation, but if you take the second one, okay, then the answer after one term in the series, okay, of course, this is using the first 3 partial sums, so it's the very first one you can calculate, you get 1.62. Okay, and the answer is 1.64, so that's pretty darn good. And you notice that by the time you get to the 25th term, you're getting 1.6492. And the answer is 1.64493. But look, if you use the sixth Richardson extrapolation, this is incredible. Look what happens if you just take the first, now, in order to construct the n equals 6, you need the first 7 terms in the series. Okay, so we'll take the first term, the second term, the third term, and so on. And look at the answer that you get. You get 1.644935. And the answer is 1.644934. So this is off by one part in 1.6 million from 7 terms. So the series knew what the answer was. It just wasn't telling you if you added up. There's no reason ever to add up a series. The series knows the answer long before you do, and you just have to tickle it, okay, to get the answer out. Okay? And you notice that if we, instead of using the first 7 terms in the series, if you use, you know, start at the 20th term or the 25th term, look at the answer that we're getting. From just 25 terms in the series, okay, that is the 25th term in the series, it says the Richardson says the answer is 1.64493406684 7, and the answer is 848. Okay? So we know the answer accurate to one part in 10 to the 12, okay? So the error is on the order of 1 over the national debt, which is fantastic, okay? Absolutely fantastic approximation, okay? So this is just to get you, these are very, very standard numerical methods that every numerical analyst learns. And they're very, very powerful for us because what they say is that perturbation theory is really a very powerful tool. okay? It now is making it a powerful tool, because of course we can't calculate thousands of terms in a perturbation expansion. We can only calculate a few. And how many Feynman diagrams can you calculate and add up? Just a few. But this is telling us that we only need a few to add up the perturbation series, well, to add up the perturbation series if it converges. We still don't know how to add up the perturbation series if it doesn't converge, but we're going to learn that too. Yeah, you have a question.
How can we get more information out of the number of terms you use than is currently available from the number of terms in the series that you actually use? What I mean is, you get...
Oh, I'm saying it's available. You see, I'm actually... What I'm using here is the asymptotic behavior. What I'm doing here is saying that I'm making a fit to the asymptotic behavior of these numbers. So I'm putting these numbers on a curve. So this type of you can't quite see it here, but this type of asymptotic approximation here, what I'm doing is I'm fitting the partial sums to a curve. And I'm using all the partial sums and extracting all the information from those partial sums simultaneously. Rather than just looking at the very last partial sum and ignoring the first partial sums, I'm trying to include all of the partial sums. That's why I'm learning more. Okay? I'm saying the information is there, but we have to use all of the partial sums in the series to see how that series is converging to the answer. That's the strategy here. Okay, I'm trying to use all of the, trying to be Sherlock Holmes here, right? Use all of the clues that you see in the room, with the fingerprints on the mirror and the, follow the footsteps across the floor, up the wall and into a drawer, and things like that, So, yeah.
If you use this technique to compute the series, 1 minus 1 half, 1 plus 1 minus 1 4, would it work? Or?
Yeah, it may work, and it may not work. I don't know. Okay, the reason is, so we assumed, my guess is that it doesn't work that well, okay, and the reason is that we assumed, can you see, we assumed this asymptotic behavior over here, and there is no minus one to the n in that asymptotic behavior, okay, we didn't put it in, but because this is an oscillating partial sum, in that series, okay, you can try it. It's a good numerical experiment. Because there's no oscillation in that series, there's only powers of 1 over n, it's probably not a very good asymptotic approximation. So it probably won't work. Okay. So in general, so I can't give you a precise statement, because obviously this is not precise mathematics. Okay. This is sort of applied mathematics. Useful mathematics, okay? Rigorous mathematics is beautiful, but it isn't always useful. So the point is, we want to make the best fit that we can, so we look at the partial sums. If I see the partial sums oscillating, my natural instinct is to try something like a Shanks. If it's sort of monotone, these partial sums are monotone, and they're gradually getting bigger and bigger and bigger and eventually approaching pi squared over 6. So I would try something like an asymptotic series in powers of 1 over n, something like that. Okay? If that isn't good, but the partial sums are monotone, I might try an asymptotic series in powers of 1 over n squared or 1 over the square root of n. And I'd fiddle until finally I saw that I was on the right, I had made the right model. Once I make the right model and I fit the partial sums to that model, I will see a dramatic increase in accuracy, as you can see here. I mean, it was clear I couldn't put n equals 8 in this table because there isn't enough room, because I need too many decimal places accuracy. Okay? So, yeah. So,
is there any analogous to Richardson or Shanks' method in continuous k case, for example, when we want to compute an integral and then somehow we form an integral differential equation to find that?
The answer is Richardson extrapolation itself is deeply connected with evaluating integrals. Okay, so let me answer your question. Let me give you a detailed answer to your question. If I said to you, you have to evaluate an integral, I give you a complicated integral, which you can't do analytically, okay, and you want to do it numerically, what do you do? You take the range of integration. You take the range of integration, okay, and you introduce a lattice. Okay, so you're integrating, you know, integrating from A to B, some function f of x dx. Okay, so here's A and here's B, and you introduce a lattice or a partition or whatever you like to call it. Okay, and then what do? So you might use a trapezoid rule, right? Or you might use, which is a 1 over n squared approximation, or you might use a higher approximation, more accurate approximation than a trapezoid rule. Might introduce a 1 over n to the 4 approximation, something like that. But you can do much better than that, okay? Really, really, really accurately. How do you do it? Well, it's really clever. And it's called, by the way, it's called Romberg integration. Do you know the term Romberg? Okay. How does Romberg work? Does anybody know? Most people think of it as just a canned routine. It's ingenious. Okay? I wish I had invented it. Really clever. Okay? And it's so simple. Instead of using a higher order scheme, like an 1 over n to the 4 scheme or a 1 over n to the 6 scheme, something like that, we'll use something really lowbrow, like the trapezoid rule. Okay, so we just introduce here, say, 100 points in the partition. We use the trapezoid rule. Okay, and we'll call that A1, 1 for 100. Okay, standing for 100. Okay, now we introduce 200 points, okay? And we'll get an answer. We'll call that A2. This answer is not very accurate because we only introduced 100 points. And the function that we're trying to find the area, you know, this integral may be a very complicated function, okay? And we've only introduced 200 points in the partition. And then we'll introduce 400 points, okay? And we'll call that A3. And we'll introduce 800 points, and we'll call that A4, and so on. Now, eventually, this converges to the right answer, but it converges very slowly. Why? Because we're only using the trapezoid rule. And it would converge a little bit faster if we used the 1 over n to the 4 rule, or 1 over n to the 6, but still not particularly fast. Okay. And now what do? We use Richardson. Okay, and we Richardson these numbers, and we make a Richardson table, and it converges like a shot. Okay, and we get fantastically accurate evaluations of integrals. Okay, so for numerical integration, that's how Romberg integration works. Okay, it's really clever. I mean, applied mathematicians have done some pretty clever stuff in the past. Okay, any other questions? Did you? Somebody thought I saw. Yes, yeah.
You know, when we are doing these extrapolations, we're always using an AN plus 1 and AN plus 2. So mm-hmm. If we get even faster conversion, could we use, for example, 5 partial sums in our formula?
Oh, but that's what we did. That would be R4.
Oh, yes.
Okay, so R4 uses 5 partial sums, R6. Uses 7 partial sums, a sequence 7 in a row, okay, and it's particularly convenient to make a table and look at the convergence and And what's nice about Richardson is that you get feedback. You make a table, and you say, ah, it's working. So you know the answer. It's really fantastic. Okay, so it will tell you the answer long before your computer would tell you the answer if your computer is just summing up the series. That's the point. Okay? All right. So,
yeah. Is that for the Shanks we use it for oscillating series?
Typically.
Is there like a good rule for when to use a Richardson extrapolation?
Yeah, I would say if the series is not oscillating.
Yeah,
if it looks like the partial sums of the series, it doesn't have to be a series, by the way. Richardson is just extrapolation. It's the way to extrapolate to the limit, finding the limit of a sequence of numbers. And so is Shanks. In this case, the sequence of numbers happens to be partial sums, but it could be anything. It could be measurements at various temperatures, or, you know, it's just, these are generic extrapolation procedures. In our case, we're applying them to finding the limit of a partial sum. That is, we're extrapolating to the partial sum at infinity, which is the sum of the series. That's the point. These are just clever ways of extrapolating to the limit of a sequence of numbers, if the limit exists. Okay? Of course, if the series is divergent, then the limit of the partial sum does not exist. So we have to be more clever. We're going to talk about that. That's where this course gets to be really good. That's so I'm boring you right now, but you're going to see some really cool stuff. Okay. Yeah.
Do you mean that in general case we just need to tailor expand the limit thing? To keep the Taylor series and just keep the first several terms for each Richardson.
Yes, that's all I'm doing. Yeah, that's all I'm doing. And furthermore, it's a little. When I used the word Taylor, I was being a little bit presumptuous, because I assumed that it was a Taylor series, meaning that it was convergent. And we don't know that the series is convergent, and we don't care. Okay? That is to say, the series that I wrote down, can you see it? This series over here, S plus A over N plus B over N squared. No. That series, I called it a Taylor series at infinity. To be precise, it's a Taylor-like series. We don't know what the coefficients A, B, C, and so on, what they are. It's most likely that this is an asymptotic series, so that those coefficients are getting bigger, bigger and bigger and bigger, and that series itself is not convergent. And it doesn't matter. Okay? So as an asymptotic approximation, we'll talk about asymptotic series. Okay? So it doesn't matter that a series is divergent. You can use it anyway. Okay, it makes perfect sense. Yeah.
Could you just explain a little bit about what you meant by how this could be used for physical problems rather than
because you see, we may be taking data. Okay. So, for example, you know that you might want to collect data about the behavior of a physical system. I mean, working in the laboratory, you may be taking data, and you may want to understand, or you may be doing it as a computer experiment. So as theorists, we might be running computer experiments. Now, you know that as you get closer and closer and closer, say, to a phase transition, you need to take more and more and more data in order to get an accurate measurement. Okay, so, you know, let's suppose there's a phase transition at 10 degrees. Okay, so first you make a measurement at 4 degrees, and then at 5 degrees, and then at 6 degrees. But to get the measurement, it takes you more and more time, and it's harder and harder. And eventually, when you get to 8 degrees, it may be taking you hours and hours and hours of computer time before you can get a measurement. And you're never going to get to 10 degrees. You'd have to run your computer for decades, okay? But it's okay. because we can take the data at 4 degrees, 5 degrees, 6 degrees, 7 degrees, and 8 degrees, and now extrapolate to the result at 10 degrees. I mean, that's the point, that extrapolation schemes are typically very, very useful, whether or not we're doing summing a series or, you know, this is just numerical extrapolation. Very, very powerful method. Yeah?
You said before that this sequence 1 over n squared, it goes like s, like the nth partial sum goes like s plus 1 over n.
Plus a over n.
Plus a over n. So you can't really assume that it goes like a over n plus b over n squared. So you can't really, why can you do the second Richardson extrapolation? On this guy.
Oh, in fact, it does go like a over n plus b over n squared, because all I'm doing is I'm saying s sub n is a function of n. And I can expand that function of n into a Taylor series at infinity. That's what I mean. So, you know, a Taylor series about, you know, if I say expand the function f of x into a Taylor series about x equals a, that Taylor series has the form sum of a sub n x minus a to the n, sum from 0 to infinity. That's the form of the Taylor series. And a sub n is the nth derivative of f over n factorial at a, at x equals a. Okay? A Taylor series at infinity would have the form sum of a sub n over x to the n. Okay, and the only assumption I'm making is that f of x has a Taylor expansion, which is valid for large x, about x equals infinity. And the partial sums do have a Taylor series. It may be only a formal Taylor series, because we don't know whether or not this series is convergent. But it certainly has a Taylor series, which is valid for large, in this case, x was capital N. Okay, do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah, no, I see what you're saying, but you specifically showed that all the terms in the series like sum up and go like 1 over n. Like, so.
No, I didn't. Wait.
I think it's because you were adding up, like you said, Sn is like the first.
Yeah, that's a model. I said, let's assume that these partial sums have a Taylor series or a Taylor-like series, which is valid at capital N equals infinity, which is the point that we want to investigate. So I expanded about capital N equals infinity, and I assume that the nth partial sum, a sub n, has a series like this, a series of the form a sub j over n to the j. That's all I'm assuming.
Yeah, but I mean, last class, at the end of last class. You took this sum, this series, and you said that the a n, the nth partial sum, is equal to the limit plus the rest of the terms, and the rest of the terms you
oh yes away. Yes, so we estimated the error. Okay, that's a standard thing to do. What we said was, so we were asking, what is the error, you know, how accurate if you say a sub n is the sum from 1 to n of a n for a sum, okay, then, you know, if a sub n tends to the sum of the series s as n goes to infinity, then what we're saying here is the error after n terms, the error after n terms is the sum from, let's say, n plus 1 to infinity of a n. That's what we're not including.
So how's that different from, like...
So then what I did, all I did was to say, we are not going to evaluate that sum, but rather what we can do is to write an integral which approximates this sum. So all I did was to say, let's calculate a n dn. That's all I did. Okay, so in our case, a n, you know, we're evaluating a sum. A n in our case is 1 over n squared. So we calculated the integral of 1 over n squared dn. And this is 1 over capital N. Okay, that's all I did. And this is an estimate of the error. Okay? Okay, so if you have a series which is monotone, or a sequence which is monotone, as we do here, these numbers are all positive numbers, then I can approximate this sum by this integral. And all I'm using is the simplest possible approximation. No, I'm just saying an integral, you know, we're adding up these numbers here. We can think of these numbers as adding up areas, and I'm just approximating these numbers by a smooth curve. So there's a little bit of error, which is over here and over here and over here, but who cares? Okay, that's very tiny. When n is very big, this error is very, very tiny. So I can approximate a sum by an integral. We do that all the time. You know, that's one of the tests for convergence of a sum. Approximate it by an integral, evaluate the integral, and see how big it is. Okay. All right. So I've shown you, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
But in a phase transition, everything goes crazy. So
yes. Yeah, yeah. That's a good point. And it is true that maybe there is, as you go to infinity, maybe there's some sort of jump. Maybe there's a discontinuity. Okay? So it could be that you're going to get a wrong answer. But what you will get is the limit of your measurements. Okay, that is to say, if the measurements are analytic in some way, you're going to find, you know, you may have a sequence. All I'm saying is you have a sequence of numbers like this. Okay? And this limit may approach, this may approach some limiting value, and you're going to find that limiting value. Okay? But it could be that there's a discontinuity here, and that the actual number, if you approach from this side, it could be here. Okay? So all you're calculating is the limit of this sequence of numbers. It may be the wrong answer. And maybe the answer is that there's a jump discontinuity here, and we are only going to get one answer, which will be this. It could be that if you approach it from the other side, you get another sequence of numbers. Could be. Depends on the nature of the phase transition and so on. But this is simply a way to extrapolate to a limit. Okay, that's all. Okay. Okay. Now I want to do something, however, that is, when we're trying to accelerate the convergence of a series, I want to do something that is really, really useful. And I want to talk about, let's see. Let's pull this up. Okay. What I want to talk about is something that is really, really important in mathematics, and this is Fourier series. And I'm sure you've all seen Fourier series before, right? Have any of you not seen a Fourier series? Or? So what I'm going to do is I'm going to start from the beginning. I want to teach Fourier series as if you've never seen them. You may be a little bit bored, but I want to show you that I want to teach them, in my opinion, the right way. And I want to claim, I certainly myself, when I was taught Fourier series, I was taught them the wrong way. And I think most people don't explain Fourier series right. Fourier series are very, very important, very powerful tools, and the reason I'm teaching you Fourier series is that they are notoriously slowly converging. Okay? And the reason, one reason for teaching you Fourier series is that when you get the answer, when you're using Fourier series to solve a problem, and you finally express the answer in the form of a Fourier series, you almost always find that this Fourier series is very disappointing because you put it on the computer and it takes forever to converge. And there's a reason why it takes forever to converge. So we have to learn how to improve the convergence of a Fourier series. And that's exactly on the theme of this course. Okay, so I want to motivate, before we even talk about Fourier series, I want to motivate I want to try to motivate Fourier series in the first place. Why do we ever use Fourier series? Okay, so if I had a problem to solve, I have to say I wouldn't think of using Fourier series first. If I needed to find an approximate answer to a problem, you know what I would use? I'd use the Taylor series. Okay, so if you have, you've had, I'm sure you've had an elementary course in ordinary differential equations, and what you learned is that if you have an ordinary differential equation that's very hard to solve, you try using a Taylor series. They're very convenient. So let's, here's an example. Y prime of x equals cosine of xy. First of all, this is just a first order differential equation. Very simple equation. How do you solve it? Does anybody know how to solve it? Well, that's an approximate solution, but do you know how to find the exact solution? Let me give you an initial condition. Say y of 0 is 1. What's y of x? How do you solve it? Does anybody know? Yeah? What do?
You Fourier expand it?
Oh, no, but that's an approximate solution. This is, I'm asking for a closed form analytic solution. How you do it? Yeah?
You try to change your variables like v equals xy, something like that.
V equals xy. Okay. Now, you might be right if we had the differential equation, if we had the differential equation, say, y prime is cosine of y over x, I would do exactly what you said. That's because this is called an Euler equation. Okay, it's of Euler type. It's a scale invariant equation. And if this were the case, you would be completely right. You would say let v be y over x. So y is equal to vx. So y prime is v prime x plus v, okay? And you plug this in. You plug this in and you'd say v prime x plus v is equal to cosine of v, right? And you'd subtract v from both sides, so this is cosine of v minus v. And you have solved the equation. Why? Can you tell me why this represents a solution to the equation? It's separable. That's the key word. It's separable. Okay, so it worked. So here your idea works, but it doesn't work over there. Okay, in fact, it doesn't make any progress at all. In fact, if you think you know how to solve this equation, I want to talk to you, because nobody knows how to solve this equation. This is a really, really hard equation, and the trick that you were proposing there doesn't work for this equation. It doesn't work at all. This is an example of a really, really hard equation. Okay, and there is, I mean, first order differential equations, you may have taken a course in differential equations and walked away from the course thinking that, you know, you write down a differential equation and you solve it analytically. No way. Only a set of measure zero of differential equations can actually be solved analytically. Okay, so this is, you know, I would give you a $10,000 reward if you can solve this, because we can write lots of papers on that equation. I'd love to do that. But we can solve this equation approximately, very easily, by using a Taylor series. So what do I mean? So this is not an exact solution, of course. So this is a perturbative solution. And for our perturbative parameter, we're using x. Okay? So we are doing a simple version of perturbation theory. We're going to say let y be equal to, now what is the unperturbed solution? Well, we're going to perturb around x equals 0. So y of x is equal to 1 when x is equal to 0. Plus ax plus bx squared plus and so on. It's a very natural idea. Okay? So what we have done is we have incorporated, before we've even begun our work, we have incorporated the initial condition. It's already there. So the Taylor series is beautiful. Taylor series is really, really beautiful because before we even begin to solve the differential equation, the initial condition is incorporated. Isn't that clever? It's already there. And now we simply plug this in to the differential equation. So first we take a derivative of this and we get a plus 2bx plus, if there's a cx cubed here, we get 3cx squared and more terms on the left. And then on the right, we have cosine of x times y. And x times y is x plus ax squared plus and so on. Okay? But we're going to treat x as small. Let's assume that x is small compared with 1, compared with 1. Okay, so x is a very, very small number. So the argument of the cosine function is very small. So we can expand the cosine in a series valid for small argument. Remember, just remember that cosine of a small number is 1 minus epsilon squared over 2 plus epsilon to the 4th over 4 factorial, and so on, right? So we can expand the right-hand side as 1 minus 1/2 the square of that. Okay, and the square of this is x squared plus higher order terms. Okay, so now we have a Taylor series on the left. We have a Taylor series on the right. Taylor series are unique. Okay, Taylor series are unique. So therefore, we compare the coefficient of x to the 0 power, and I learn that a equals 1. Very simple. Okay. Now we compare the coefficient of x. Well, there is no x on the other side. Okay, so I conclude that b is equal to 0. Now we compare the coefficient of x squared. And I get 3c, that's this, 3c equals minus 1/2. Okay, so c is equal to minus 1/6. Okay, so we have reduced, it's just typical perturbation theory, we've reduced an infinitely hard problem. This is an extraordinarily, by the way, I could give you a seminar on this differential equation. It's fantastically interesting. Really a fascinating differential equation, but we won't do that now. Okay. However, we're finding the solution, and the solution is y of x is equal to 1, and a we said is 1, and b we said is 0, and c we said is minus 1/6 x cubed, and so on. So we have a Taylor expansion for the answer. And how would you use this? Well, you plug in the value of x, and you have a very good approximate solution to the problem. Of course, we don't have the exact solution, but if this Taylor series is convergent, we have an arbitrarily accurate approximation. Okay? So it just depends on how much work you want to do. Okay? So, conclusion, Taylor series are very powerful. So now I'm going to make an interesting point. If Taylor series are so useful, we should be able to use Taylor series to solve partial differential equations as well. That's an ordinary differential equation. Partial differential equations are very important to us as physicists because every important physical theory that we're interested in working on, from quantum field theory to fluid mechanics to electricity and magnetism to gravity, it doesn't matter. It's always expressed in the form of a partial differential equation, you know, like Maxwell's equations. Okay, so so let's see how well we can do if we want to solve a partial differential equation. So here's an example of one. This is a simple wave equation. How about ut plus CUX is equal to 0. That's a first order wave equation. Have you ever seen this before? It's a linear wave equation. Can anybody tell me the solution to this equation? Do you know, by the way, do you know the notation UT, UX? Yeah? You know, UT is just shorthand for DU DT, right? UX means DU DX. Okay? And we're looking for the solution U as a function of X and T. Can you tell me, does anybody know the solution to this equation? Sorry? C, say it again, CT? Okay.
Function of?
I would say X minus CT, but it doesn't matter. X minus CT. That's right. Okay. This is the most general solution. Okay? And you can see that if you plug this into the equation, if you take the time derivative, take the space derivative, it makes the equation true. And F here is arbitrary. That's an arbitrary function. Okay. Do you see physically what this means? This represents a wave of this is the simplest wave equation you can imagine. This describes a wave of unchanging shape traveling to the right. So this is a right going wave of unchanging shape with speed c. Okay? So for example, if t is equal to 0, we set the time equal to 0, what does the wave look like? Here's x. Okay? The wave looks like f of x. Okay? Whatever function you like, f of x. It doesn't matter what the function f of x is. Okay? Now, suppose you take t equals 1. Okay? Now, the function, the wave has the form x minus f of x minus c. Okay? F of x minus c. That's what it looks like at t equals 1. So it's exactly the same function, except it has moved to the right a distance c. Okay? So we have here a wave that is traveling at t equals 2. The wave looks like this. So it's now traveled an additional c. Okay? So it's traveling along at the speed c. It's a right-going wave of unchanging shape. Okay? Now, of course, we have f is any function. And that depends on the initial condition, right? So specifically, to determine f, we want to say u of x and 0, the wave at time 0, is some given function, say capital F of x. That's what the wave looks like at time 0. Could be any shape you like. And in that case, that fixes f in this case. So the solution to this differential equation and that initial condition is u of x and t is f of x minus ct. That's it. Okay? That's the solution to the wave equation. Okay, so imagine you didn't know that, and you needed to find that out. So you say, I don't know how to solve that differential equation. It looks very, very hard. But I've been told that Taylor series are a way of solving a differential equation that I don't see the answer to analytically. So let's express u of x and t in the form of a Taylor series. Okay. Now, since the initial condition is given at t equals 0, and since we want to incorporate the initial condition in the Taylor series, okay, you understand what I'm saying? I want to incorporate that initial condition. I want to make a Taylor series in powers of t. Seems natural. So I'm going to say let u of x and t be the sum from n equals 0 to infinity, a sub n of x times t to the n. Okay? Seems obvious. And a0 of x is our initial condition. At t equals 0, a is equal to f of x. So I haven't said a word about Fourier series. I'm just talking about Taylor series. Okay? Is that clear? So now, you know what we want to do. We want to plug this into the differential equation and compare powers of t. Right? So first, the differential equation says you have to take the time derivative. The time derivative, ut, if you take a derivative of this, you get the sum from n equals 0 to infinity, a sub n of x times n times t to the n minus 1. OK? And by the way, there is no 0 term, right? There's no 0 term. So this is really 1. OK? And by the way, I can do a shift. I can replace n by n plus 1. Let me do it. Let me replace n by n plus 1 so that the sum, instead of going from 1 to infinity, is now going from 0 to infinity. So this is a sum from n equals 0 to infinity, a sub n plus 1, n is being replaced by n plus 1, of x times n plus 1 times t to the n. Okay? And now I have to take the space derivative. Okay? I have to take ux, and ux is equal to the sum from n equals 0 to infinity, a sub n prime of x times t to the n. And then I have to multiply this by c, right? c. Okay, and the differential equation says if you add this series to that series, you're supposed to get 0. Okay, Taylor series are unique. So if I add the series sum from n equals 0 to infinity, t to the n times c a n prime of x plus n plus 1 times a n plus 1 of x, this is supposed to be 0, right? So therefore, for all n, I conclude that a sub n plus 1 of x is equal to minus c a sub n prime of x over n plus 1. Got it? You all see that? Great. So this is a recursion relation. So it says if you know a0, which we do, a0 is f of x, then you immediately know a1. So from that recursion relation, I see that a1 is equal to minus c, n is equal to 0 here, okay, times a0 prime, which is f prime of x. And a2 is equal to c squared times f double prime of x over 2. And a3 is c cubed with a minus sign f triple prime of x over 3 factorial, and so on. You see that coming out automatically? So therefore, if I plug it back in here, you can see what we're getting. What we're getting is that u of x and t is the sum from n equals 0 to infinity, 1 over n factorial minus 1 to the n times f nth derivative of x times c to the n. OK? You all see that? Can you sum that series? It would be nice if we could. Can anybody sum the series? Oh, times t to the n. I forgot to write t to the n. Can anybody sum this series? What is this series? It's the Taylor series of F, okay, this is explicitly a Taylor series, so I have an immediate answer. The solution is F of x minus ct. This is merely the Taylor expansion of F of x minus ct. Done. So we found the answer. This is the solution to the wave equation. Beautiful. There's only one problem here. This is a little problem here, a tiny little problem. We needed to make an assumption here that the function capital F has n derivatives. It doesn't have to. Why is it that the initial condition to the wave equation, why do you need to assume that this initial condition here has n derivatives? It doesn't have to be n, you know, differentiable. You understand we worked it all the way out to infinity. So we're assuming here that F has an infinite number of derivatives. It doesn't have to. So to get to the answer, we had to make a very powerful assumption, which is completely unwarranted, namely that the function F of x, which could be a smooth function, actually has an infinite number of derivatives. We had to actually make the assumption that F was an analytic function. Okay, but nevertheless, we got the answer. So we should be pretty happy. At least we got the form of the answer. Okay, so it looks like Taylor series are really, really powerful ways of solving differential equations. Well, they're not. And now it just barely worked in this case. Let's do a slightly more difficult problem, just a slightly more difficult problem, and I want to show you that they are not, and that Taylor series are a disaster. Okay? So I'm going to write down a slightly more complicated differential equation. Okay, let's write down the differential equation ut equals uxx. Can anybody tell me what is this differential equation? What does it describe?
Diffusion.
Diffusion. Okay. This equation, this is a one-dimensional diffusion equation. It represents the diffusion of heat in a one-dimensional wire, for example. Okay, so U stands for the temperature. U is a function of x and t, and it's the temperature of a wire at the point x and at time t. Do you all understand this? And this represents the heat diffusion in a wire. Usually, people like to put in a diffusion constant, sigma, but we'll take it to be one. It doesn't make any difference. Okay, now, I'm going to give you the initial temperature in the wire. The initial temperature in the wire, U of x and z, zero, this is the initial condition. So the initial distribution of temperature in the wire is, say, f of x. Okay? Let's see if we can solve this equation, okay, using a Taylor series. So I'm going to incorporate this initial condition over here. Let's see. Ha! It's already written. Look at that. Okay? We've written down the Taylor series. We've incorporated the initial condition in the Taylor series. This looks perfect. This is just great. Okay? And we've taken the time derivative, and here it is written right here. This is great. Okay? And now, instead of taking one space derivative and multiplying by c, what I need to do is to take two space derivatives. So that's easy. Uxx is that. Okay? So if I plug it into the differential equation, let's write down the differential equation. So if I plug this into the differential equation, what is the coefficient of t to the n? Okay? On the left side of the equation, ut, the coefficient of t to the n, it says, is a sub n plus 1 of x times n plus 1. And on the right-hand side, the coefficient of t to the n is a n prime prime of x. So this is great. Why did I suggest that Taylor series are a problem? we have just found a recursion relation. It gives me a formula. If I just divide by n plus 1, this gives me a formula for a sub n plus 1 in terms of a sub n. So I'm going to write down the solution to the diffusion equation. This says, just using this formula, we know that a0 is f of x. a1 is two derivatives of this divided by 1. A sub 2 is four derivatives divided by 2 factorial. Okay? A3 would be 6 derivatives divided by 3 factorial. Do you all see this? It's very simple, very straightforward. Okay? Any problems? So here's the solution to the diffusion equation. The solution is u of x and t is explicitly the sum from n equals 0 to infinity, sum from 0 to infinity, t to the n, times 2n derivatives of f divided by n factorial. Bingo. So what's the problem? There's the solution. It's written down in the form of a series. It's just wonderful. So let's try. This is not a Taylor series, okay, so I can't sum it up, but it's I've written it down. There's the answer in the form of a series. Let's take as a typical, this is when you, if you've solved the heat equation in an elementary course in mathematics, you know, you often take as an initial condition f of x, say, is e to the minus x squared or something like that. Okay, so the initial distribution of temperature looks like a Gaussian, like this. Okay? So this is at t equals 0. Here's x. Here's f of x. So here's the wire is very hot in the middle. And at a later time, we expect the heat to diffuse. So this temperature will go down, and the solution will look like that. And the heat will gradually diffuse out to infinity. Right? This is a simple physics problem. Okay? So now, let's go back to this. Here's our solution to the problem. Let's ask a simple question. What is the temperature at the origin as a function of time? Very simple question. So u of x and 0 is the sum from n equals 0 to infinity, t to the n, times f 2n evaluated at 0 divided by n factorial. Okay? Oh, I'm sorry. T of 0 and t. U of 0 and t. Okay? So let's. What do you get if you calculate the 2nth derivative of this? Remember, this function is the sum from n equals 0 to infinity minus x squared to the n, okay, divided by n factorial. If you take 2n derivatives of this and set x equal to 0, 2n derivatives of this, and you set x equal to 0, what are you going to get? You're going to get minus 1 to the n times 2n factorial over n factorial. You take this and you plug it in here, and you get the sum from n equals 0 to infinity, t to the n, 2n factorial minus 1 to the n over n factorial times n factorial. Okay? This series is this is interesting series. Before we quit, let's just work out the radius of convergence of that series. Does that series converge? It's delicate. Let's remember, so we know what n factorial is, approximately for large n. For large n, n factorial, forgetting constants and things like that, is roughly n to the n e to the minus n. Right? So this, the nth term in this series here, is approximately t to the n, 2n factorial would be 2n to the 2n power times e to the minus 2n times minus 1 to the n. Okay, and the denominator contains 2n factorials. So n to the n, e to the minus n to the n, e to the minus n. Okay, I'm just using Stirling's approximation for n factorial here, for large n. Okay, you all know this, right? N factorial is approximately n to the n, e to the minus n. So, look what happens. It's very interesting. We have an n to the n and an n to the n, and here is an n to the 2n, which cancels. Okay, and here we have an e to the minus n and an e to the minus n and an e to the minus 2n. So this is roughly minus 1 to the n, 4t to the n. Okay? In order for this Taylor series to converge, how large can t be? What is the largest possible value for t? Say it again. A quarter, which is really interesting. So our Taylor series is only useful if t is less than a quarter. That's the radius of convergence. Why? You know that if you represent a solution to an equation, a physical problem, by a Taylor series, that there's a singularity, something bad happens, something abrupt happens at the radius of convergence. Are you telling me that if you take an initial temperature distribution in a wire that looks like this, and you wait 1/4 of a second, something goes wrong? Are you crazy? The heat is simply smoothly diffusing out to infinity, and it continues to diffuse forever, but the Taylor series stopped converging. What? Does anybody have an answer? What's going on? It's a really interesting problem.
Something happening on the Colbert spring?
That's a very good idea, but in fact, it's not happening in the complex plane. But something is happening. It's really happening for real t. It's not obvious, okay, that your guess is very good, but in fact, it's simpler than that. Something really is happening for real values of t at absolute t equals 1/4. But what?
It comes to a direct delta minus 1/4.
Very, very good. You see, what this is saying, remember, Taylor series always converge in a circle. Therefore, they include not only positive values of t, but negative values of t. If we were to postdict, not predict what's going to happen, but postdict, that is to go backward in time, if you go backward in time, you notice as time goes forward, this is a diffusion equation, time is going forward in diffusion, you know that things don't diffuse backward in time. This explains entropy. Okay, the universe is spreading out. It's not unspreading out. But Taylor series converge in a circle, so if they include positive values of t, they also have to include negative values of t. So if you go backward in time, so this is t equals 0, if you go to a time where t is less than 0, the solution becomes even more sharp. And if you continue to go backward in time, the initial condition is getting sharper and sharper. And finally, at t equals minus 1/4, this Gaussian has now become a delta function, a sharp spike delta function that is no longer a smooth function, is no longer analytic. And that's why the Taylor series is breaking down. What we did in trying to solve the heat equation, the diffusion equation, by means of a Taylor series is that we did it too generally, because we forced the solution to exist for negative times as well as positive times. But things only diffuse forward in time. So Taylor series were not the right Taylor, were not the right series to use. And this is not a problem with ordinary differential equations. This is typically a problem with partial differential equations. So we need to find a series that does not converge in a circle, because the series we used includes both negative values of t and positive values of t. Okay? We used a technique that was too powerful. So this is the reason. So what we're going to do next time is we're not going to use a Taylor series. We're going to generalize this series. We're going to stop using a Taylor series. And we're going to say, wait a minute, we're being too clever here to use t to the n. This is too strong. This is too strong. Too strong an assumption, and we're going to put in a more general kind of series. We're going to say, let's look for a solution to the problem of the form sum from 0 to infinity, a sub n of x, and instead of saying we're going to use a Taylor series, we're just going to put in b sub n of t. This is more general than a Taylor series, and we're going to try to find an a sub n and a b sub n. This is called a separated variable series. It's more general than a Taylor series. And we're simply generalizing t to the n, and we're placing that by b sub n of t, where b sub n of t is some function or other. Okay? And when we seek a solution in this form, we're going to go back and solve the heat equation, and we're going to do it better. Okay? And we're going to get a series that doesn't converge in a circle. Taylor series are too strong. And we're going to discover that the solution is in the case of the heat equation, is a Fourier series. And that's going to motivate us to study Fourier series. And we're going to find that we can solve the heat equation using a Fourier series. But the problem is that Fourier series are not like Taylor series. They take forever to converge. So we're going to have to learn how to get the answer out. It's one thing to write down the solution to the heat equation. It's another thing to figure out what the answer is actually meaning, okay? Because they converge so slowly. So this is a really interesting topic. Okay, so that's what we'll do next time.